Rod Richardson. Rod, how are you?
I'm fine, and yes, I am the only radio engineer in the room, so it's very easy to win those accolades. Thank you very much, Duo.
You know, I am the great statesman of the obvious, and part of the obvious thing about this show is it's one of the most interesting shows we've done here at Homepage Radio, because many times we're talking about concepts and ideas and definitions, but here we are talking about a specific place. So while you're listening to this, I want you to do two things. I want you to think about calling at 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. But also go to the WPKN Facebook page, and on there is a video, and also on there is a group of photographs of this project, the project we're going to be talking about today. And the reason why I think it's good for you to see that while we're talking is because we are really talking about a specific place. Like every month here at Homepage, you're talking about home. And the truth is, people love where they live, or they want to love where they live, but even if they don't, they have to live somewhere. And so many people care about the way they look, or what car they drive, or how they speak, or some very important things, but since we all live in a place, a lot of us actually deeply care about how that place feels and looks. They want to create a home. And this often means that they are trying to capture some spirit or essence or flavor that captures who they are, not only reflects who we are, but projects that and supports that and sends it out to the world, but also just fulfills their own personal need to have their home be their largest extension. And because of that, this show really focuses on the fact that it takes human beings to create their own homes, and many times, most times, human beings resort to something like decoration. A couple months ago, we had on Kent Bloomer, who teaches at Yale, and he essentially defined the sacredness of decoration versus the secular kind of shilling world of interior decoration, where people use paint and draperies and chairs to make something which really does reflect them. But the art of decoration, beyond wallpaper, beyond light fixtures, and that can translate into a higher order for people. Like what you'll hear today, some people actually think it's really, really important to own where they live, to actually own a place in the world. There are over 60 million freestanding homes in America that are owned. It's a world record for the percentage of Americans who actually own where they live compared to the rest of the world. And in fact, that percentage may be going down. More people are thinking about renting. But truth be told, the majority of people that have a place to live own a place to live in America. And because of that, people always want to build new. They want to actually build something that is they can rely on, that actually is an investment. And they always want to have it reflect them in some way. But the vast majority of people that do that, over 90% of the people that actually create and own a new place, create a new place based on stock plans, plans they find on the internet, plans they find in a book, plans of a house that a friend has. They take those plans, they go to a builder or builders, and they say, make this work on this site. Or they go to a place that already has a site, and they say, do you have a plan? And they say, sure, here's the plan. Well, that lack of direct integration into the design process saves a fair amount of time. It saves some money. But often it can cost a lot. It can make a home that doesn't fit. It can make a home that maybe is too big or too small. It could make a home that is not well considered in terms of just maintaining itself, not leaking, not actually being having the natural light or the ventilation that prevents the need for you to spend a lot of money for the utilities that sort of compensate for those lack of things. But the truth of the matter is that there are those people that not only want a place to live, to own a place to live, and to build a place to live, but a minority of those people, the people that want to build a place to live, actually hire a designer to work with them over months, sometimes years of time, to actually create a set of drawings that depict something that really reflects and manifests their destiny. And it really takes a home, and it makes it into my home. And that's what this is about today at Homepage Radio. It's really about the last best, most intense bite of place, and that's building your own home, but also designing your own home. And so that phrase, designing your own home, for most people means dream home. And we've called this show Dream Home because basically one little family in a state of transition decided, you know what, I want to build my dream. I actually want to create something which manifests the thoughts and hopes I've had for my entire life. And now I'm at a certain stage of life where I can actually build that thing. And of course, it's a risk. It's also a time dump. It's also just an enormous amount of money and of uncertainty, because owning a set of plans or owning a house or even renting a house is far safer than creating a house from scratch, not knowing what it costs, and then sending it out to get numbers back and dealing with that and actually hoping that what you're doing, although idiosyncratic to you, has value in the world. In a world where all house values are in flux because of the Great Recession that we had almost a decade ago, the fact that the idea that there's no expectation of never-ending appreciation in house value, that in all of this there is courage. Courage that despite the headwinds of uncertainty, time, and money, that core, deep, abiding feeling that almost everyone has, that where they live, where they go home to go to sleep and wake up in the morning, when this happens, it will mean more to them because they've had a process where they've been included in its creation. So today, we're going to take a peek into one of those little places where a young designer, a family in the city of New Haven decided that the risk was worth it, that it was time, transitions had happened, and they could create the scenario where they could trust a builder, trust the designer to make something that hadn't been made before, and they actually did it. They created a place that is quirky, it's interesting, it's theirs, it's not a raised ranch, it isn't the standard issue home, but it also fit their budget, fit the site, and reflects the values of the owners, which is not that common. And it is, for me, an architect as well, something that I've dedicated about 38 years to. But I can tell you, even though I've done that, the vast majority of people think of it as idiosyncratic, really risky, and not mainstream. But today's story is about a very mainstream proposition. This isn't a mansion. It isn't a crazy spaceship. It isn't some statement about culture or art or life. It is simply the genius of a young designer and the courage of a family at a point where they could downsize. And it's created something which, if you go to the Facebook page, you can actually see they created something which is at the very least interesting and at the best maybe inspirational. So joining us today in studio is designer Colin Kaplan, who is more than just a designer. He's sort of a peripatetic, I would say, entrepreneur of ideas and aesthetics, and he has his own website, which has got a ton of different things going on, called MagrisoForte.com. I won't spell it. You'll just have to figure it out. His name is Colin Kaplan with an A, not an I, so that's a little bit different. You should be able to find him on the internet. But he met journalist Nina Lentini in one of his many sidebar venues, which is he does tours where they eat and drink, especially pizza. I think there's some weird, Colin, there is some kind of weird psychic, romantic connection between you and pizza, correct? Am I right about that?
Yeah, I believe that pizza was ingested while I was in utero.
Many times, obviously.
Maybe only.
Only? Well, was it also when you were being whelped? Was it when you were being sort of fed by your mother's direct contact?
Yeah, I think the Gerber baby food was probably the pizza variety.
and joining him today is this classic client. Having had 700 clients myself, I can tell you, you meet clients in any different shapes, manners, and forms and ways. And her name is Nina Lentini, and she is an editor. She was on the Pizza and Pints bike tour. Nina, could you just tell us about the Pizza and Pints bike tour?
Sure. Well, this is the first time I ever met Colin. The first time I had been on such a tour. I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. I went with a girlfriend who hadn't been on a bike in maybe forever. fortunately, Colin is the bike whisperer, so he got her courage. And we ended up biking, I think it was 18 miles. It was supposed to be like a four-hour tour. I think it was more like a six-hour tour by the time we got home.
Wow.
And it was really good. We really got to taste just super, super pizza. And we went to five different places.
Wow.
Including one in Westville.
So this was sort of like a pizza crawl.
Yeah, on a bike.
On a bike. So anybody lose any of the pizza gastronomically? Did they imbibe too much? No, everything went well?
No, everything went very well. In fact, at the last place, we were given lots and lots of pizza to take home.
Oh. So how many people were on the tour?
I think there were six.
Oh, so this is quite intimate.
Yeah, well, they range from about that many to as many as 30, I understand, right, Colin?
Yeah, the pizza tour, the bike tour, we usually stop at about 16 so that everyone gets a slice, you know.
You eat 16 pieces of pizza and bike?
Oh, no, not the slices. Okay. But people do eat up to 15 slices on that, not 16.
Okay.
But no one bit it, meaning no one fell either.
That's, or got hit.
Yeah,
that's a main concern.
That's a main concern. I was on the New Haven Habitat board for years, and we had a major fundraiser that was a bike tour, and we had some tragic results because biking and beer are not exactly too easy to coexist species after the third or fourth or fifth pint.
As long as you space it out.
Yeah, and you got to get some blotting paper in there to absorb the ethanol. Everything is good. But in that very informal, very, I would say, enforced friendship of riding and eating together, Nina, you discovered that Colin was a designer.
Yeah, we were having pizza, I think, at Zupardi's. We were there. And he mentioned that he studied architecture. And my girlfriend kicked me under the table because she knew that we were looking for somebody to help design our house.
There you go.
And that was it.
Well, Colin, this is a good time for me to sort of delve into to your sort of, I guess, architectural vitae. I mean, you, like me, I went to Cornell in architecture school, and you went down south. You're a New Haven boy, right, that went down to New Orleans, to Tulane?
Yeah, I was excited to try a new city when I was young, and
right.
I went, oh God, the first step I took into the French Quarter and the neighborhoods in New Orleans, I was stricken.
Yeah.
It was such a cool cultural experience immediately, and the school was great. Architecture school there is very intense.
Yeah.
5-year program,
yep.
Beautiful Beaux-Arts style and Beaux-Arts schooling. You know, and it was it's not for everybody. We lost half of our class after, you know, 3 years.
Yeah. And we matriculated 140 at Cornell. We graduated 38 on time. I mean, we graduated probably about half at the end, but it's not for everybody. And having said that, a lot of that has to do with the potential misfit of architecture to culture. Many people think of architects as being too elite, too costly, not really representing basic human values like money and time, more or less thinking about aesthetics and treating clients like a cash register. And so, Nina, tell us about your life at the time you met Colin. Where were you with your family, with your present home? Tell us about your family and the home you had when you met Colin.
Okay, so in 2014, so 3 years ago, we moved from Norwich, Connecticut, mm-hmm. Where we had lived for 17 years, raising our two daughters. And once they went to college and they were out of the house was too big, and we wanted a more urban lifestyle, where we could walk around, we could go to good restaurants, and there was entertainment. And anyway, so we looked around.
Now, you had children?
We have two grown daughters.
And when did they move out?
They, let's see, one went out into, well, went to college in 2008.
Right.
And never came home. And
thank God.
And the other one graduated from high school in 2010. She was still in college in Boston when we left.
So you and my kids are almost exactly the same age, mid-20s, and we had the exact same thing happen to us. We had those people leave, and I would say if we have 30 or 50 jobs in the office at a given time, I would say most of those jobs have to do with the change in circumstances in the client's lives, whether they become single, whether their children leave, whether they're having children, whether or not they have a job, whether or not they have actually making enough money they can think about adding onto a house they lived in for a while. What made you want to divest yourself of the family home where you raised your two daughters?
Well, interestingly, my parents had passed, my father in 2013, in Cheshire, where I grew up, and they left a huge house with a lot of stuff in it.
Oh, my goodness.
And my siblings and I, you know, had to deal with all that. And
right.
I thought, I mean, we'd have stuff, not as big as my parents, but I thought, I don't want my kids to have to go through this eventually, you know.
Right.
Have to rifle through everything. How do you get rid of it? Do you save it? How do you save it? So... So we decided we wanted to downsize, and we thought, well, let's go to an apartment.
That'll make rental, like many people in New Haven are doing, and also everywhere.
Yeah, that's what we did. Well, we thought about where we would go, and we thought many different places, maybe closer to our daughter in Charleston or near Boston.
What business do you do that you have that level of flexibility, or in your husband as well?
Well, that's just it. I have flexibility because I'm an editor, and I work on an online magazine for a company that's in New York City, but publishes
online. But you work at home a lot.
So I work at home.
Great.
Yeah, on a laptop. And now an iPad. But my husband, however, is a retired journalist.
Oh.
And he took a job as a security officer at Mohegan Sun Casino. I know. When we lived out there.
That's wild.
But he kept the job because, number one, he likes it. The benefits are good.
Yeah, sure.
And we own property up there.
Wow.
So he can stay a couple of nights up there and not have to go back and forth every day.
But you really wanted that walkable, less lawn mowing, urban experience of being part of a community in a neighborhood, having been in Norwich, which probably was more land, more dependence on cars, and also kid land where you raised kids.
Yeah.
And that, and your scenario, by the way, is repeated by millions of other people all across the country. I think the baby boomers, you and I are baby boomers, we're reaching an age where there are, some, in some ways, fewer options, but there's also some greater clarity about the fact that the dependence on the American dream of the 1 acre and the two cars and the kids, that passes, and it's passing our society in general. And into that comes Colin. And Colin, are you even, you're not even 40 yet, right? How old are you, Colin?
Thank you. No, I'm not. I just turned 39. I am proud to say I'm at the threshold of...
of antiquity.
No, that's 50 years old.
Decrepitude?
Historical at 50.
Okay, so I'm 61. Does that mean I'm already dead?
No, no, no. You're well-aged.
I'm like a bad cigar. So... We've set this. We've actually set the stage now for all of our listeners. We've set the stage that basically we have a family that's transitioned, and it's a husband and wife. Their kids were raised. They've left this home. They've got the extreme object lesson of a parent dying and having this incredible mishigas of unending decisions and angst and Sturm und Drang of liquidating a lifetime of assets and debts and badnesses and saying, not for my kids. And then we find a true, what I would call, cultural nomad, somebody that not only does these tours that I said, but Colin Kaplan's written many books, mostly about architectural history and mostly about the architectural history in the greater New Haven area. So you have these two humans that coincide in a very weird way. They coincide on a bike tour. And the coincision is not just about booze and pizza and bike riding. The coinciding is about what everybody who's listening out there has, the desire to manifest their destiny in their homes. So when we take a music break, think about calling 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And telling us your story, very quickly, just tell us if you are at the edge of or have decided that it's time for you to either build your home or really create a home that really is about you and reflective and supportive of you. This is Homepage Radio on WPKN, one of the great radio stations in America, and a station that totally deserves all support you can give it, to go to their website and donate to them, because without your donations, we wouldn't be here. So please go to the WPKN website, see pictures of the house we're talking about, nicknamed, by the way, Bijou. That's a teaser. Bijou. And when we come back in a couple minutes, we'll be talking to Colin and Nina about how did they actually do this? How do they create this home? And how's it going after a time of occupancy? Welcome back to Homepage. This is Duo Dickinson. I'm an architect, and every month we use an hour of your time to listen to issues about creating a home and a place to live. And with me is Rod Richardson. Rod and I last month did a show, or maybe it was last month, about objects, and we're talking about how objects and home came together. And before the show began, Rod mentioned to me that there was actually a wonderful anecdote about his ascendance into, I would call it, a domestic awareness via an object. What was that, Ron?
Well, when we bought the first house that we now have as a couple, me and my wife, one of the first things I did when we actually closed on it, aside from tearing wallpaper off of one of the walls, which was a very symbolic thing to do, is I have this this ceramic owl I created when I was in fourth grade. And it was defective from the very moment I fired it up because parts of it like fell off in the kiln. So it has this sort of like beaten up look, even though it's glazed and all the rest of it. But I've had it in my life since I was, you know, in fourth grade, which is now quite some time back.
Yeah.
And so when we moved, the first thing I did was I took that owl and I put it in the center of what is now our dining room, as a way of sort of saying, here we are, this is home, and boom, that little totem just sat there until we finished moving all the rest of our stuff into the house.
Did it make any noises or proclamations? Did it offer any wisdom?
No, it just simply sat there and offered itself for contemplation.
Well, that gets into the religious aspect of life, which is another show.
Yes.
And this show, though, has got two people in studio with me. One of them was Colin Kaplan. Colin is an architectural designer, went to Tulane, but he also runs these, I would call, alcoholic and high carbohydrate tours involving pizza. In fact, he handed me a gift to me, I think, although he might take it back, called New Haven, A Pizza, which is one of his many books that he's done.
A Beats.
Well, it says there's an A at the end.
Yeah, no, it's pronounced A Beats.
And what happens to the A?
A Beats.
It's gone. Is that with mutz?
It's like the mutz. It's like, what do you say, you know, certain kinds of cheese, regatta?
I say bourbon mostly, but anyway. So Colin's here, but also Nina Lentini is here, who is an editor, and his client. But at first, she was a client for his bike tour of imbibing and gastronomic and ingestion. And we're going to now talk for this middle third of the show. We're going to talk about something which I want to make sure that the audience sort of follows, because it can get a little inside baseball, but it's also really the mechanism by which anything gets made, whether it's a rug or a car or a spaceship. You have to start with the criteria and the technology available and the means and methods, and you have to actually go through the fit between what's possible and what's desired. And usually that ends up having money as its barometer. But initially, Nina, could you tell us, you'd met Colin at this booze fest, and you and your neighbor were there, and you'd known after your experience of liquidating your parents' homes that you really didn't want to have that legacy on your children of this giant home, and you really wanted to get into a walkable cities environment with a neighborhood and restaurants and just not dealing with the damn car all the time. Tell us your vision of the home before you even met Colin.
I don't know that I had a vision of the home. I would say my husband probably had a vision. He always wanted to build the family manse to leave to the children. And he would talk about it, and that, to me, it was pie-in-the-sky dream. You know, we were never going to build a house. And so, we moved to New Haven. We lived in East Rock section,
okay,
which is up Upper State Street.
Right.
And we had an apartment. I thought, we'll just live in an apartment forever. I don't want to be a homeowner again.
So you had actually sold your home, rented the apartment, and your husband had the burning desire to have his own manse.
He did, yes.
And that came through you when you met Colin.
Well, what happened is, I always walked the dog, and so I was walking the dog in the neighborhood in East Rock, and there's a real estate office on the corner of State and Edwards. Mm-hmm. And I would look at the things in the window, you know, and I happened to see a vacant lot for sale.
Vacant lot in downtown New Haven.
Yeah, I didn't know where it was really, and so I was looking online.
It's Tilton Street.
Tilton,
right?
Yeah. It's near the Science Park.
Yes.
Yale Science Park. So at first I thought, no, I don't want to live over there. And
all of five blocks away.
I know. So I did nothing. And about a week later, I said to my husband, you know, I saw this vacant lot. You want to take a look?
Wow.
And then we bought the property. I think it was before we closed, but we had...
How long ago was that?
That must have been August of 15.
So actually exactly 2 years ago.
Yes. Yes.
That's an incredibly swift and great process.
Well, thanks to Matt Bowman.
There you go. And Matt Bowman, by the way, is the builder of this extravaganza, and he'll be joining us in the final third of this show. But so you had the lot in hand. You had the lot in your pocket when you went on the bike tour.
Right. And that's when
my girlfriend
said, hey.
You know. What were some of your husband's visions that he had besides just a manse to live?
Well, I know he was into Art Deco.
Okay.
In fact, that we have certain things around our house that are from that design period.
Right.
Because we both like them. But, we're not going to make a museum out of it, you know. So they were just incorporated into our lives.
Right.
Naturally. So that, I think, once we had this lot, at first I think he thought, why don't we just get a prefab? We'll just get a prefab.
The normal way to go.
On there.
Bang.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But we investigated that route, and he didn't like what he saw.
Right.
So that's when along came Colin, and I invited him to come over and meet my husband and sit down with us, which he did for about an hour or so.
Right.
And we talked about what we wanted.
Right.
And Colin took a lot of notes, drew out some things.
You can actually see, by the way, on the link to my blog, you can actually see some of those sketches that Colin did on there at the first meeting, and actually you can sort of begin to see how human the process is.
Huh. Well, yeah, it is very human. He did come back to us some weeks later.
Yeah.
With the design.
But you clearly, and Colin's handing out some of his little scribbles right now, but you also clearly signed a contract with Colin. There was a professional relationship. You were actually working together.
Well, first he was showing us what his design was.
Right.
And then we signed it.
Right.
Once we agreed to go ahead with what he was showing us. But when Richard and I sat down with the first draft that he presented, and we both went, that's our house.
There you go. He had listened.
Yes, he had.
And not only he listened, I think a lot of what people have to understand is that when you go into the design process of anything, the actual empathy and sympathy and connection between the designer and the person using the design either is there or it's not. And so my take is that that Pizza Bike Fest was an incredibly great way to have a sympathetic introduction. So Colin, pull back a little bit. We know you went to Tulane. We know that you are sort of gadabout in town, do all these great things. I know you went to architecture school, but tell me about your design practice. I'm not really sure that I'm familiar with this, all the stuff you've designed. So tell us what sort of stuff you've worked on over the years. I know you've worked for a lot of truly great architects in the greater New Haven area as an architectural intern, but tell us the stuff you personally have worked on.
Sure. I actually also, I forgot to mention to you, I did work for Kent Bloomer for...
There you go. Everybody did.
Yeah. He's so...
An amazing man.
Magical.
A wonderful human.
Yeah. What a great studio. So, over the years, I worked in housing development,
right,
helping to fix up old homes. And
on your own or without somebody else?
Neighborhood Housing Services.
Oh, so you worked for Neighborhood Housing, Warner Marshall.
Not Warner. This is Jim Paley's.
Jim Paley's, that's right. That's right. We just gave them an award at the New Haven Preservation Trust.
Yeah, and so that was really an incubator for my design skills right out of college, even during college. When I was not working for a landscape architect, who was Doug McLeese out of Guilford,
right.
Years ago, and or other architects like, you know, Robert Orr.
Right.
That was great. I was able to refine my CAD skills there.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to use CAD. I was able to, you know, do some interiors and get these, squeeze a lot out of a small house, like these ancient old houses.
Right.
Where, you know, how many doors were in your old house, Nina? That you were like, why are there 8 doors in my kitchen? During that time, I started working freelance on commercial and residential properties for homeowners, business owners.
Right.
And in Connecticut, you don't have to be
a licensed architect for anything under 5,000 square feet.
Right.
Almost anything. Basically, public accommodation, they still require a lot of license. I'm a licensed architect. That all the difference between me and Colin, as I went to a 5-year program as well, is I did the licensing exam pretty quickly. Colin's already done all the internship he'll ever need, and if he wanted to, we could probably go ahead and take the licensing exam. And many people that have worked for me have had it. Most people have not had it. It's not necessarily a necessity. It's a nice thing to do, but it involves sort of a level of commitment and time that many people feel has no natural reward. And given the diversity of your expression in books and tours and everything else, I could see how that could easily just not be part of your life. But more importantly for me is, what have you designed yourself personally that led you to this place? Because clearly there's a facility and a knowledge of your own design skills here. So tell me about some of the stuff you designed personally.
Sure. I've worked on a lot of additions and facade renovations. So downtown New Haven, I've had clients who we fixed up old buildings, like the old Horowitz building.
Oh, good.
Which is now Family Dollar. I even did a Family Dollar renovation in Cheshire.
Wow.
Where they converted this Richard's Corner on Whitney, or whatever it's called there, Route 10.
Route 10, yeah.
We converted it to a nicer looking building, kind of like a lifestyle design, they call it.
And it's just you don't have any employees, you're the guy, you're just doing it.
I'm doing it.
So we now know where the two of you have been, we now know where the site is, we actually get the fact that you guys are together. Colin, walk us through the design, quote-unquote, process. Tell us how you got to where you were. Besides that first introductory thing where you show a design and it seems to relate to them, tell us how many meetings, what did you show them, did you build models? Tell us what you did.
Sure. So, like Nina said, it was really an initial meeting, getting to feel out what they like, what they're into, and I think that's a great way to start, is to listen, and listening to what they want, what they need. A lot of what we learned in school was, you know, program.
Right.
You know, the actual design doesn't really matter. It's really about getting the space right so that people can live in it. You could literally build a box and somebody might be very happy there. So listening, getting some ideas, and then it's really after, you know, intake, it's actually you have to meditate. I had to meditate on the site. And
did you show them multiple options, or did you give them one first, this is what I think is good?
We sketched.
Together, side by side?
I sketched, they viewed, and I drew a bunch of little sketches on my initial meeting with them that they started to say, yeah, we like that, yeah.
So it's actually almost as if you're having a design conversation.
Yeah. It was
And it was facilitated by email. So Nina, tell us, did you bring into this images of things you liked or drawings of things you liked, or was it all just verbal?
No, I think it was all just verbal.
Which is also very interesting because many clients do the exact opposite. They'll have 100 images from Houzz or other places. They'll have copious lists. They'll even have site plans they've drawn almost to perfection or to wildly inaccurate scales. And I don't think there's really one way to deal with a client. I mean, I've done with very many, and right now I'm dealing with a client that draws to within an inch, and I'm also dealing with a client that has drawn nothing and just talks.
Mm-hmm.
So there really is no correct way. And in all of this, there was a builder, and his name was Matthew Bowman. And they bid the project out. Cost was a real issue here, and it has been published, so I can say this. It was a very accessible budget, $200,000 to build the house. And that informed everything, but it also served as a screed for the value of the design, and the fact that you could build this beauty for that money meant that there was a tangible relationship between cost and what you believed in and what you liked. So right now we're going to have a music break, and we're going to call up Matthew Bowman, get him on the phone, and we can talk about, now that we've gone through the design process, the drawing process, we can begin to see how the construction process went. Welcome back to Homepage Radio. Homepage Radio happens once a month here at WPKN, one of the great radio stations around, and totally listener-funded, and deserves your looking at the website and also looking at their podcast list, which is extensive, and the podcasts of Homepage are also there and prove to be quite popular. This show itself will be podcast probably in about a week, and I think what you'll be able to do is, if you found some things that are interesting, go back and listen to them, or if you know people that didn't hear it and you think they should hear it, you could actually tell them what to do. We did not reach Matthew Bowman because he's a builder and he's probably screaming at his son who's on a building site somewhere, probably putting a 2x4 in the wrong place. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Colin about the bidding process and well, let me pull back. Tell me a little bit about the drawings you prepared to create an accurate bidding scenario.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, it's actually scary for a small firm to try to do everything.
Right.
You know? And as you know, there's so much that goes into it. We didn't build a model.
No.
We literally went from what we call schematic design, probably past design development, right into construction drawings.
Right.
So the drawings that were initiated actually converted into construction drawings and bid drawings because they are so simple.
Right.
So that those
and the drawings, house, and let's just pull back a little bit. The house is only 1,000 square feet, right?
No, it's actually less than 700.
Say it's 699.9 square feet. And if you go to the website of WPKN and you the Facebook page, and you go to the website and you take a look at what's going on, you will actually see a house which is extremely decorous at the street with stark contrast in materials and geometries, and at the back has a complete split personality of windows and almost a three-dimensional form in terms of the corner, which Nina is said in many of the writings that I've seen about this, that you really wanted to make a corner window and actually embrace the small urban lot and bring the lot inside. Is that right?
That's right. I had seen it done on a smaller scale in a house on Livingston Street in New Haven. And I even pointed it out to Colin one day when we were driving past. And I said, I'd like to have something like that. But it was hard to make because you couldn't support, it wasn't a supporting wall. I mean, gotcha. There it wasn't a supporting wall. Here it would have to be. And so what he did instead was create a wall of windows and against another wall of windows.
Right.
And
forming a corner grid of mullions, and in between is glass. Mm. And what makes it architectural versus, I would say, just sort of normal home stuff is, if you take a look at those photographs, you'll see an extremely graphic, two-dimensional, deco, interesting facade, decorative, but also linear and transitioning. And at the back, you've got a complementary gray white kind of I would call it an organic form of windows looking at the rear, and that little transition in a very tiny house in a 700 square foot house with two bedrooms, I think it has.
Yep.
Two bedrooms and a very high open space going from what, 15 to 18 feet high in the space?
12 to 15,
yeah. With a loft up above it and some very stark contrasts of materials in it. There's like a wood cube that takes up an entire corner, is that right?
Yeah, so basically the bedrooms where they are separated from the rest of the house is
rest of the tent.
Yeah, is clad with basically a almost like a shiplap type of board, so it looks like the exterior.
What type of boards were those?
Those were V-grooved pine, very like low grade pine, so they could have the biggest knots possible.
Yeah, so they were just purchased at a Home Depot and bang bang bang. They didn't have any provenance. No,
and actually part of it was what's available for the budget, with the time constraints, a lot of things had to get value engineered.
Yep. That the phrase that you use, value engineering, tell us the first method of value engineering in any construction process is the bid process itself. You get these numbers back from people. And did you bid out to more than two? I know you got two bids back. Did you bid out by more than two?
No, we only did, since it was basically a private, you know, bid offering. It wasn't like a public bid or anything like that. We bid it out to a couple contractors. One I knew, and one Nina knew. And having a high school relationship as a friendship doesn't hurt.
No.
You know somebody. And
that was Matthew for you, Nina? You knew Matthew?
Yeah, I've known Matt actually since kindergarten.
Wow.
Our parents knew each other. And yeah, we go way back.
That's impressive.
And I turned to him because the first bid that we got was so high.
What was the first bid you got back? Because people should hear this, that it isn't like buying a car. There's a wide range of dollar values ascribed to the exact same design in any bidding process. What was the high number for you guys?
I think it was 270, is that right?
Yeah, and you got it down to 200 or less than 200.
Actually less than 200.
Less than 200. So there you really had a 30% discrepancy, which in my experience is not weird or strange at all. Mm-hmm. And in fact, usually the first bid is almost always the highest bid, mm-hmm. and the last bid is almost always the lowest bid. And I think there's an interesting relationship there. What changes, Colin and Nina, did you have to make the project affordable?
Well, you know, some of the bigger elements in a building are obviously the windows.
Yep.
How many? What are they made of? That was a big change. We went from, you know, having finely built corner windows that are actually assembled by, I believe, Marvin or Anderson, to going with vinyl. Mm-hmm. You know, which
or like a replacement window.
In this case, new, but, you know, yeah.
But they call them replacement
windows. They call them replacement windows. Right. So we made that change. We also went from a stucco facade because the Art Deco often was concrete and stucco.
Correct.
in its finish. So we went from stucco in the very last call where we would have to wait until after winter to apply it to
Correct.
Do it correctly. We actually went to a composite, a fiber composite that was nailed or screwed on vertically to simulate that kind of flat exposure.
And you had made that extreme contrast to the gray lines that are actually defined by the circular windows in the facade. What are those lined? What is that gray made out of?
The gray is hardy board.
Uh-huh. It's a straight concrete board. Yeah,
and it's also to simulate clapboards, which is basically the nomenclature of the neighborhood.
Right.
And So we use some of that hinting of trying to match the neighborhood with striation, with clabbered, and then going with a completely different type of look, obviously. And the material, this sort of fiber board that we used was cheap.
Right.
It's has a good product rating. It could be built at any time of the year, and we could use the carpenter instead of using a whole other set of contractor people.
How long was the construction process?
It started October 10th, I believe.
I think it was.
October 10th, and then it ended.
Well, we moved in March.
That's very good. That's 6 months. Mm-hmm. That's really fantastic. How long was your design bidding process?
That was probably in about a month, because we got the first bid, and then...
But how long were you designing before you got the first bid?
Oh, it must have been about... Three or four months.
And that's also very good and very direct, and a month-long bidding process. Sometimes it goes to 2 months. That's very normative. And the idea of doing a house in about a year plus is more normal than not normal. People are like, oh my God, that's so much time. Well, to build a raised ranch house with stock plans takes 4 or 5 months, just that. And that's just because there are lots of people that have to do many different things to make a house finished. That extra 3 or 4 months, and I'm not going to ask how much, but I'm sure there was money paid to Colin, and that was money that you would not have paid had you just gone with a stock plan. Those things are choices you make to make a home that you see on the WPKN Facebook page and website. You can actually see what this looks like. And this sounds bad, but it's not bad. It's sort of a billboard facade, meaning it's a flat facade with one projecting roof. What was the roof behind that facade? What roofing material did you use behind the facade?
So the main roof, one shed roof, like
one
you said,
dumb shed roof, right?
Which literally could just be seen and from the back is asphalt shingles,
just shingles,
and no one else is seeing it besides the rear neighbors.
Right.
And then you basically have what we call a parapet, which is on the front.
Right.
And that parapet wall is a mask. It's a facade. And it's what they did in the old Wild West towns.
Well, also what they did in Deco. Deco really is about two-dimensional, almost graphic design of buildings, and also using the line as something which is highly animated. And if you go look at the photographs, you'll see there are circular windows. There are also pendant lights that are also cylinders with circles. And there is a little bit of skew geometry that makes the regularity involved with the front facade seem almost more stoic and stark and two-dimensional, because the back becomes more organic, or the interior becomes more organic and more deformed and more playful. And the kitchen's totally open and looks into the living room space. There are shelves around as opposed to cabinets sometimes. So there's definitely a high degree of, I would call, idiosyncratic but really delightful detail in the house, which I think is really due to both of you, because in my practice as an architect, what I find is that it's the homeowner that has got obsessional detail consciousness and often inspires us to do very interesting, different things to satisfy them. Is that true in this case?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a Richard and Nina putting their heads together, telling me what they wanted, and I said, look, you're living here.
Right.
I'm not going to live, well, maybe... If it's on Airbnb.
Well, knowing that your wife is a wonderful person, she could kick you out at any moment, and you might just be there.
only if she needs the space. I would do anything for her.
Well, that's a good thing. Tell us how the relationship, since Matthew can't come here, because I'm sure that he's probably putting out the fire in a burning construction site, the joys of live radio. Tell us about the relationship with the builder. How did that go during the course of the construction? Was there ever any stress points to your long-term friendship with him, Nina?
Oh, no. No. Matt is just a marvelous person and a very good friend. I was so lucky to have a builder I knew, I could trust. I don't know how anybody does it with a stranger. But he would tell me ideas that he had, and he would say, well, if I was going to live here, that's what I'd put in. I go, fine, that's what we'll do. Because he's built a lot of homes in his life.
And where's he based?
In Cheshire.
It's in Cheshire.
Yeah, that's a big family. They're all involved.
So it's Matthew Bowman, builder in Cheshire. You should probably even look him up if you're interested in seeing what he does. Mm-hmm. Because what I tell people, and Colin, you don't quite have the experience I do, but I think you'll agree with me, is that there are a lot of good architects out there, a lot of good designers out there, a lot of wonderful clients out there. But if you've got a good builder, you can actually not have those and still have a good house. Conversely, if you've got a really crappy builder, you can be the best architect in America or the best designer in America, the best homeowner in America, and still have a very, very painful building experience. So builders become a focal point, a fulcrum of the possibilities of a house that have been scoped out by the designer and the client. And if the builder can follow through on that, it becomes really a joy, I think. And Nina, I was going to be asking you in the last few minutes we have in this show, I was going to ask you, what did you learn from this whole process? You've only been in now for about 6 months. Mm-hmm. What have you learned from actually the process of building and occupying? And obviously, you've created new friendships here with Colin and reaffirmed an old friendship in Matthew. How did it affect also your relationship with your husband and your children? How did this all work for you?
That's a good question. It all came together so well. I sit in that house, and every day I get up, I just think this. We made this happen. Hmm. And I know Colin said this once to me. He said, "You created history. You created this house." And I think, yes, we did. It's just such a wonderful place to live in. When they were building it, I was on site almost all the time.
Right.
And I watched the carpenters at work.
You were blocks away. It was easy.
I rode my bike over. But the carpenters would work. I had a new appreciation for the trades, the electricians, the trimmers, people who do this every day of their lives and do it really well and really care.
And did you find that you were good through the whole process with your husband? There weren't any fights or arguments? Were the kids upset? Or the kids happy?
The kids, first of all, are out of the picture. I mean, one's in Boston, one's in Charleston, South Carolina. So they are just getting email updates, and photos, they were excited for us. Right. Very excited for us to have this house. And I look forward to leaving it to them. I mean, that's really another consideration that I wanted to leave something like this.
And did your husband feel that he'd fulfilled this macho thing that a lot of men have of like writing a book, having a child and building a house? That's what one man told me one time. But he's done those three things. That's what makes it.
He's already written a book.
There you go. You see?
He is.
Had kids, evidently. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's a writer and he's written novels and if you want to know what it is, give me a call. he's really fulfilled a lot of things that he's desired in his life, and he loves this house. Very, very happy.
Colin, in the last three remaining seconds, tell us what this project meant to you.
This was my first sole practicing full house construction from the ground up. This meant freedom, friendship, and design dream come true.
Yeah.
And it was more fulfilling than many other projects I've ever worked on, and now I get to be on the radio with you again.
Well, I know. I'm sorry about that, but my impression is this might even be on TV and on Monday. Did I read that?
Yeah. We'll be on WTNH 8. They interviewed us there, and I believe it's a 12 and a 3 o'clock?
I think it's 5 o'clock.
Oh, 12 and 5, and then we'll also be again on TNH with Ann Nyberg on the 29th of August.
I'm really delighted that I scooped Ann Nyberg in this story, and I am incredibly grateful for WPKN for hosting Homepage Radio, and I want to thank everybody who's listening, and I want to encourage you to go to those websites and look at this wonderful house. Thank you so much. I'll see you in a month, 4th Thursday in August, Homepage Radio.
Support for WPKN comes from Grillo Services of Milford, Connecticut, supplying organic topsoil, organic compost, mulch, dumpsters, decorative gravel, and more to Connecticut's residential, commercial, and municipal customers. Detailed information on all their organic garden and landscape services at grilloservices.com or 203-877-5070.
This is Hazel Kahn, WPKN News Director, asking you to consider joining our terrific team of volunteer news editors. Not for you? Please think again. You don't need to have editing experience. You don't have to be a major news junkie, although it helps, and you should enjoy working with words. As news editor, we would ask you to commit to 1 or 2 hours on the same one day each week on stories sent to you by your producer. You can work from home, and for WPKN staff, your time will count towards your volunteer hours. If this does sound like you, please contact me at news.director@wpkn.org. I will reply promptly. Thank you.
Corn in the fields, listen to the rice when the